Imagine you are walking down a familiar staircase in the dark.
Oh, yeah, like in your own house.
Exactly. You have walked down these specific stairs 100 times before.
Right.
Your brain knows the exact distance between the steps, the exact angle of your descent, and the exact amount of pressure your foot needs to apply to catch your weight.
It's completely automatic. You aren't even thinking about it.
You aren't. And you reach the bottom, and your brain signals to your body that there is one final step left. You confidently extend your leg, you brace for the solid impact of the floor, and you just step down into absolute empty air.
Oh, that is the worst feeling.
Right, your foot just falls through
Right.
space. That jarring physiological jolt, that sudden, almost violent disconnect between what your brain absolutely guaranteed was there
Yeah.
and the total void you actually encountered.
Yeah, the heart drop feeling.
Exactly. That is exactly what we are staring at today for this deep dive. You, the listener, are being handed the label instead of the actual experience.
I mean, it is the cognitive equivalent of reaching for a glass of water, taking a massive gulp and realizing the glass is completely empty.
Yes.
The anticipation of the physical sensation makes the absence of it feel incredibly loud.
It's deafening. And right out of the gate, I want to frame what we are doing today, because you, the listener, have handed us something that borders on the surreal.
It really does.
Our mission on this show is always to take the source material we are given, strip it down to the studs, examine the mechanics of the information, and figure out what it actually means for you in a practical sense.
Usually that means untangling dense webs of data.
Right, or navigating complex arguments.
Well,
But
today
today,
it's different.
very different. The source document we receive presents an entirely different kind of challenge. It presents itself as a window into the mind of a highly scrutinized figure.
Which is a huge promise.
Massive. The text is titled, and I'm going to quote directly from the source here, "How Warren Buffett Thinks About Money."
Which is a phrase engineered to command immediate
Oh,
attention.
that's.
I mean, when we talk about the mechanics of information processing, a title like that acts as a profound cognitive trigger.
It's a hook.
It's a massive hook. It does not suggest a casual observation, it suggests a definitive roadmap.
Okay, so let's unpack this, because this is where that feeling of stepping into empty air happens.
Right.
The document we are looking at explicitly labels itself at the very top. It announces its format before it even begins. It says, "Excerpts from How Warren Buffett Thinks About Money."
And that word, excerpts, is doing a lot of heavy lifting.
It is. And yet, underneath that bold declaration, underneath the promise of curation and condensed wisdom, there is absolutely nothing but the repetition of the title itself.
Nothing else. Literally just the words, How Warren Buffett Thinks About Money, typed out a second time.
It's wild.
No bullet points, no introductory paragraph,
No pulled quotes.
no data tables, no concluding thoughts, nothing. The text consists of a frame, and inside the frame is just a smaller, identical
I
frame.
have to pause here, though, because my immediate reaction to this is not just frustration.
Right.
It's almost a sense of being mocked by the document itself.
Mocked. How so?
Well, I want to float a hypothesis by you. Is it possible that we are looking at this entirely the wrong way?
Okay, I'm listening.
What if this isn't an information void? What if this is a deliberate, almost avant-garde statement?
Oh, interesting. Like what?
Like a Zen koan. You ask the master, how does one think about wealth? And the master just hands you a blank sheet of paper,
Ah, right.
implying that the secret is silence or inaction or the absence of complex strategy. Could the author be making a profound point about how the ultimate financial strategy is to not over-intellectualize it?
That is a very romantic interpretation of a blank page.
I'm trying to give it the benefit of the doubt.
No, I get it, but I have to strongly push back on that framework.
Okay, why?
The danger of treating an information void as a profound intentional mystery is that we start projecting our own narratives onto it.
We do the work for them.
Exactly. We start doing the author's work for them. If we look strictly at the structural mechanics of the words provided, which remember is all we have, the word excerpts destroys the Zen Koan theory.
Wait, how does one word destroy it?
Because excerpts is a mechanical term. It implies a larger pre-existing body of text from which pieces have been actively severed and presented. You cannot excerpt a profound intentional silence.
Okay, that is a really fair counter. You are saying that the word excerpts is a structural promise of a specific type of physical or digital content.
Right, it's a logistical claim, not a philosophical one.
It's an administrative word.
Precisely. Let's break down the mechanics of the cognitive dissonance the reader experiences here.
Yeah, let's get into the brain science of it.
Think about the phenomenon of a phantom limb. A person loses an arm, but their neurological mapping still expects the arm to be there.
Right, they feel pain in a hand they don't have.
They feel an itch on a hand that does not exist. The brain fires the signals, the expectation is fully formed, but the physical reality fails to meet the neurological demand.
Wow.
When a reader sees the word excerpts, their brain immediately fires off a specific set of neurological expectations.
It preloads a template.
Exactly. They prepare to synthesize, they prepare to encounter dense, high-value information that has been pre-filtered for their convenience.
Because that is the implicit contract of curation.
Yes, the contract.
When you, the listener, see the word excerpt or summary or highlights, you are engaging in a transaction of trust.
Right.
You are saying, I am trusting that you, the compiler of this document, have waded through the noise and are now presenting me with the pure signal.
And that is an incredibly seductive promise.
Especially now, when we are all drowning in an ocean of content, we crave the shortcut.
And that craving is exactly what makes the subsequent void so jarring. The document exploits the human desire for efficiency.
It totally does.
The word excerpts acts as an accelerant. It tells the reader, you don't need to do the heavy lifting. The heavy lifting has been done for you.
Here's the pure extracted value.
But when the eye drops down to the actual body of the text, it encounters a mirrored surface. It encounters the title again.
The signal-to-noise ratio doesn't just skew.
It collapses entirely because the signal is just announcing its own existence.
It reminds me of the famous René Magritte painting, you know, The Treachery of Images.
Oh, the pipe
Well,
painting.
one with a highly realistic painting of a pipe, and underneath it, the text reads, "This is not a pipe."
Right.
The point Magritte was making is that you cannot stuff tobacco into the canvas and smoke it.
Exactly.
It is merely a representation of the thing, not the thing itself.
Yeah.
This document we have today is doing exactly that, but without Magritte's self-awareness.
Yeah, there's no irony here.
It presents the words how Warren Buffett thinks about money and tries to pass off the representation of the knowledge as the knowledge itself.
What is truly fascinating here is how effectively the words function as a facade.
Let's talk about that.
If we consider semiotics, the study of signs and symbols, we have a signifier and a signified.
Okay, define those for us.
The signifier is the word or the phrase pointing to a concept. The signified is the actual concept, the substance, the reality being pointed to.
So the word is the signifier.
Right. In a functioning piece of communication, the signifier acts as a bridge to the signified.
So if you read the word apple,
Your brain accesses the memory of the taste, the crunch, the red skin, the signified.
exactly.
But in this document, we have a signifier pointing to a void. Or rather, we have a signifier pointing back to itself.
Also an infinite loop.
An infinite loop of signifiers with no underlying signified. Let's look at the specific language of the title because every single word is doing heavy lifting to create the illusion of substance.
I love this. Let's break it down word by word.
Consider the first word, how.
How is such an aggressive hook?
It really is.
It is entirely different from what. I feel like if the title was What Warren Buffett Thinks About Money, my expectation would be drastically different.
How so?
What implies an inventory, a list of opinions? Like, he thinks money is useful, he thinks inflation is bad. It is static.
That is a crucial distinction. The word how implies a mechanism.
A mechanism, yep.
It implies an operating system. When a reader sees how, they are not expecting a list of facts. They are expecting a blueprint.
They want the instructions.
They are expecting to be shown the internal gears and pulleys of a cognitive process. How promises methodology.
Right.
It says, if you read this, you will not just observe the outcome of the thought process, you will be able to replicate the machinery of the thought process yourself.
It's the difference between someone showing you a fully built house and someone handing you the architectural blueprints and the power tools.
Yes.
The word how promises agency. It promises that the reader will be empowered by the end of the text.
Which is a huge promise.
And that makes the betrayal of the empty page so much sharper. You showed up ready to build, and there are no tools in the box.
And then we follow that promise of machinery with the subject of the machinery, the name Warren Buffett.
Right.
Now, within the strict confines of this text, we aren't given any biographical data.
None.
We aren't told who this person is, what they have achieved, or why their thoughts matter. But the text relies entirely on the cultural and semantic weight of that name to legitimize the document.
I see where you are going, but let me challenge the necessity of context here.
Please do.
Does the document actually need to explain who he is? Doesn't the very structure of the title, you know, how name thinks about topic, automatically bestow authority on the name, regardless of who it is?
That's a good question.
If the document was titled, How John Doe Thinks About Money, the reader would still unconsciously assume that John Doe is an authority worth listening to, simply because someone bothered to write a document about his cognitive process.
That is a brilliant point, and it speaks to the inherent authority of formatting.
Just the shape of the title does the work.
You are absolutely right. The syntax of the headline creates an artificial pedestal. Just by placing a name in that specific structural formula, the text demands respect for the subject.
Yeah.
However, we cannot ignore that the specific string of characters, W-A-R-R-E-N, B-U-F-E-T-T, acts as an extreme multiplier for that effect.
Oh, for sure. It's a massive multiplier.
Even without the text defining him, the reader's brain immediately imports a massive amount of assumed context.
We bring our own baggage to the text.
The brain hallucinates authority, track records, and immense scale. And it attaches all of that hallucinated data to the empty document.
It is like a placebo effect, but for information.
Exactly like a placebo effect.
A sugar pill only works because the patient's brain believes in the authority of the doctor in the white coat who handed it to them.
Right.
The patient's brain does all the actual chemical work of feeling better, based entirely on the wrapper.
The wrapper is everything.
This document is an informational sugar pill. It hands you the wrapper, the highly authoritative title, and relies on your brain to generate the feeling of being in the presence of profound financial wisdom.
And the final piece of that wrapper is the phrase, thinks about money.
Which is so vague.
Notice how abstract this is. It is not how Warren Buffett invests money or how Warren Buffett spends money.
No.
Investing and spending are physical, measurable actions. They require data. They require spreadsheets, timelines, and verifiable outcomes.
But thinking is completely invisible.
Right.
It happens entirely behind closed doors. You can't verify a thought.
Precisely. By promising access to thoughts, the text elevates itself from a financial manual to almost a psychological thriller.
A psychological thriller. I love that.
It promises access to the invisible realm. It promises to map the neurological pathways that precede the physical action. And money, in this context, is not just currency.
No, it's bigger than that.
It is the ultimate abstraction of value, power, and security.
So if we take all of those pieces together, the promise of this one single sentence is staggering.
It is immense.
It promises a curated, highly efficient, shortcut, you know, excerpts to the internal, invisible cognitive machinery, how, thinks, of a supreme authority figure, Warren Buffett, regarding the most universally desired abstract concept about money.
The buildup of tension is incredible.
Which brings us right back to the moment the foot hits empty air.
The crash.
The tension is built, the reader leans in, the cognitive machinery is primed to receive the blueprint.
And the document simply repeats the title.
It hands the reader the menu and insists it is the meal.
It really does.
I want to dig into the actual experience of that moment of realization. Because for you listening to this, you have likely encountered this exact feeling, even if it's not in such a pure, unadulterated form.
We all have. Every day on the internet.
What happens in the brain when the promise so aggressively outpaces the delivery? Is it just annoyance, or is there a deeper cognitive friction happening?
Oh, it is much deeper than mere annoyance. It is a violation of the predictive coding of the human brain.
Predictive coding. Explain that.
Our brains are essentially prediction machines. We do not process the world in real time. We constantly generate models of what is about to happen, and we compare the actual sensory input against our predictions.
So we are always living a split second in the future.
Essentially, yes. When you read a headline, your brain doesn't just passively wait for the next sentence. It actively predicts the shape, the tone, and the structure of the information that must logically follow.
Right. If I read a headline that says, three ways to fix a leaky pipe, my brain immediately expects a numbered list.
Exactly. One, two, three.
If the article is just a long, unformatted poem about water, my brain fundamentally rebels. Even if the poem's beautiful, because the structural prediction was violated.
Your brain expends metabolic energy generating those predictions. When the prediction is met, there is a smooth cognitive flow.
It feels good.
It does. But when the prediction is violated, it triggers an error signal.
Like an alarm going off.
In the case of our document, the brain predicts a transition from the abstract, the title to the concrete, the excerpts.
We want the data.
It predicts the arrival of specific nouns, verbs of action, conditional statements, maybe an anecdote. Instead, it hits a wall of repetition.
Just the title again.
The error signal fires massively. The brain asks, did I misread this? Is there a formatting error? Where is the rest of the page?
It is the digital equivalent of opening a beautiful, heavy, intricately carved wooden door, expecting to step into a grand library, and finding out the door is just painted onto a solid brick wall.
That is exactly what it is.
You don't just feel disappointed. You feel mildly concussed. Mm-hmm. You physically brace for a space that does not exist.
And this brings us to a really critical juncture in how we analyze this text. Because the text itself provides zero answers, we are forced to analyze the shape of the hole it leaves behind.
We have to study the negative space.
Yes. If we look at the literal words on the page, the document is an entirely closed loop. It is a tautology.
A tautology.
Here are the excerpts of the thoughts on money. The excerpts are the thoughts on money.
Wait, let me stop you there. Yeah. Because you just called it a closed loop, and that makes me think of computer programming.
Oh, absolutely.
Like an infinite loop where the code just keeps calling itself over and over until the system crashes.
Yes.
Is this document essentially a cognitive crash? It traps the reader in a cycle of expectation and non-delivery until they just give up and close the tab.
That is a highly accurate way to model it. In computer science, a pointer is an object that stores a memory address of another value.
Okay.
It tells the system the data you want isn't here, it's over there.
Right. It points you to the destination.
The title of this document functions as a pointer. But what happens when a pointer points to itself?
You get stuck.
You get a fatal error. The system cannot resolve the request. The reader's mind arrives at the text. The text points back to the title. The title points back to the text.
There's nowhere to go.
There is no exit strategy provided by the author.
Okay, but let's play devil's advocate again.
You love playing devil's advocate.
I do. What if the loop is the point? We're evaluating this through the lens of a reader seeking actionable data. We want the blueprint. But what if this document is actually an accidental masterpiece of satire?
Satire, okay.
By promising the secrets of a billionaire's mind and delivering absolutely nothing, does it not perfectly satirize the entire industry of self-help and wealth guru worship?
I see where you're going.
Think about it. It forces the reader to confront their own gullibility. It says, you really thought I was just going to hand you the keys to unlimited wealth on a single page. The joke is on you.
I understand the temptation to assign a satirical brilliance to the void, but we have to maintain our analytical discipline.
You're not buying it.
Not at all. To call it satire requires us to assume the intent of an author we do not know, based on text that does not exist.
Ouch, fair.
Satire requires a wink. It requires a deliberate exaggeration or a juxtaposition that signals to the reader, I am subverting this genre.
There needs to be a clue.
The repetition of a title does not contain the necessary semiotic markers of satire. It is devoid of tone. It is flat.
Yeah.
It is much more probable, strictly based on the evidence of the words themselves, that we are looking at an artifact of broken, automated aggregation or a fundamentally incomplete draft.
You are systematically destroying my attempts to make this document profound.
That's my job.
And I appreciate that because it forces us back to the stark reality of the page.
Yeah.
You are saying we cannot excuse the emptiness by calling it art. We have to deal with it as a failure of information delivery.
We must evaluate it as a structural failure, yes.
Oh, yeah.
And that failure is what makes it so worthy of our attention.
Why?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this document is essentially the Rosetta Stone for understanding the modern attention economy.
Okay, now that is a massive claim.
I stand by it.
Walk me through that.
Yeah.
How does a document with zero content explain the entire attention economy?
Because the attention economy does not fundamentally run on content.
What does it run on?
It runs on the promise of content.
Ah.
It runs on the friction between curiosity and resolution. Every platform, every algorithmic feed, every news aggregator is designed to generate a hyperabundance of signifiers.
Headlines, thumbnails, push notifications.
Exactly. These are all promises. They are all cloches resting on silver platters, hinting at the meal underneath.
That's a great image. And the goal of the platform is to get you to lift the lid. To click, to engage.
Yes.
Because the moment you lift the lid, the transaction of attention is complete from the platform's perspective.
Precisely. In a perfectly functioning information ecosystem, lifting the lid reveals a nutrient-dense meal.
You get what you paid for with your attention.
The signifier leads to a robust signified. The promise is fulfilled, The reader is enriched, and trust is built.
But that's not the world we live in.
No. In a system optimized purely for the extraction of attention, the quality of the meal becomes secondary to the shininess of the cloche.
The wrapper is more important than the candy.
The incentive structure heavily favors the creation of compelling promises over the creation of substantial delivery.
Which means you end up with an ecosystem flooded with incredible titles, incredible thumbnails. You won't believe how this person thinks about money.
Right.
And when you click, the article is just an AI-generated summary of a Wikipedia page. Or a regurgitation of the headline.
Or in the purest, most extreme case we have today, literally just the headline itself.
This document is the logical endpoint of that system.
It is the absolute zero of the attention economy.
Wow.
It is a piece of media that has completely shed the burdensome weight of having to provide actual value and consists entirely of the hook.
It is all bait. No hook, no line, no sinker.
Just bait.
It is a terrifyingly efficient evolution if you look at it from a purely parasitic standpoint.
Why do you say parasitic?
Well, why expend the energy writing a 5,000-word essay on cognitive financial strategy when you can just print the title, trigger the neurological expectation, capture the attention, and offer nothing in return?
It's the maximum return on minimal effort. And that is exactly why encountering a text like this and rigorously analyzing our reaction to it is a profound exercise in media literacy.
How so?
It forces us to decouple our emotional reaction to a headline from our critical evaluation of the text.
Decouple the emotion. Break that down for me.
When you read how Warren Buffett thinks about money, you feel a spike of anticipation.
I do.
You feel a desire for proximity to that perceived wisdom. That feeling is real, it is physiological, and it is automatic.
You can't stop it.
You can't. The danger occurs when a reader conflates the feeling of anticipation generated by the title with the acquisition of actual knowledge.
Oh, wait. Say that again?
It is incredibly easy to read a headline, feel that spike of dopamine, and mentally check a box that says, I am now informed about this topic, without ever interrogating the actual substance of the article.
Oh, wow. Yes. I do this all the time.
We all do.
I'll see a headline like, New Study Shows Coffee Reverses Aging, and I'll feel that little burst of optimism and I'll scroll past it. But in my head, I have unconsciously accepted the premise of the headline as a fully developed fact.
Without reading a word of the study.
I haven't read the methodology. I haven't looked at the sample size. I haven't even read the article. I just consume the wrapper and convince myself I ate the candy.
That is the exact trap. And this document, by being entirely empty, denies you the ability to fall into that trap smoothly.
It breaks the illusion.
It creates such a violent cognitive friction that you are forced to stop and realize, wait, there is nothing here.
It acts as a speed bump for the mind.
Exactly. If the document had provided just one or two generic platitudes like, he believes in long-term value, or he reads a lot.
Which is what we normally get.
Right. If it gave you that, the brain might have accepted that meager offering, satisfied the prediction engine, and moved on, retaining the illusion of having learned something deep.
The illusion of depth is far more dangerous than the total absence of it.
Profoundly more dangerous.
If the document gave me a cliche, I might falsely believe I had uncovered the secret machinery of a billionaire's mind. But because it gave the absolute zero, it shatters the illusion entirely.
It forces you to recognize the mechanics of the bait and switch.
Which is why, analytically, the void is highly functional.
It serves as a stark calibration tool for our critical faculties.
It demands that we ask ourselves questions.
Exactly. How much weight do I assign to a title? How quickly do I surrender my trust to a formatting convention like the word excerpts?
And most importantly, how do I react when the structure of an argument or a promise fundamentally collapses upon inspection?
Yes.
I want to spend some time on that reaction.
Yeah.
Because earlier I mentioned feeling mocked or feeling a sense of betrayal.
Right.
And while we agree the document probably isn't intentionally mocking me, the psychological reality of the reader is still one of betrayal.
It feels like a broken promise.
How do we, as consumers of information, process that betrayal without just becoming entirely cynical?
That is the million-dollar question.
If the endpoints of our information ecosystem are just empty rooms with fancy doors, how do we keep walking down the hallway?
That is the essential challenge of modern information consumption. The defense against cynicism is not to stop opening doors, but to change our relationship with the doors themselves.
Okay, how do we do that?
We must stop treating the signifier as the destination. we must develop a reflex of structural skepticism.
Structural skepticism, I like that phrase. What does that look like in practice applied to this document?
It means that when you see the word excerpts, you do not passively accept it as a guarantee of value.
You don't just trust it.
You view it as a hypothesis that the document must now prove.
Oh.
The title says, here is how this mind works. Your internal response should be, show me the evidence.
You challenge it right back.
You approach the text not as a supplicant waiting for wisdom, but as an auditor verifying a claim.
An auditor? I love that.
When the text fails to provide the evidence, when it merely repeats its own claim, the auditor does not feel betrayed.
Because they weren't emotionally invested.
Exactly. The auditor simply notes the bankruptcy of the claim and moves on.
You change your posture from a consumer to an inspector.
A consumer is angry when the box is empty because they paid for the product with their attention.
But an inspector expects a certain percentage of boxes to be empty.
Right. And their job is simply to identify them and set them aside.
Precisely. And this document is the ultimate training ground for that inspector mindset.
It really is.
Because it strips away all the distracting filler, all the pseudo-intellectual jargon that usually masks a weak argument.
And it leaves you with nothing but the naked mechanics of an unsupported claim.
It is a pure, frictionless environment for practicing the identification of an information void.
It is almost like a vaccine.
A vaccine.
Think about it. You are injected with a dead, harmless version of a virus, an empty headline, so that your cognitive immune system can recognize the shape of it and build antibodies.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
That way, when you encounter a live, highly infectious piece of clickbait that actually contains harmful or misleading filler, your brain already knows how to identify the structural weakness and reject it.
That is a remarkably apt metaphor. The dead virus still has the protein shell, the title, the formatting, but the genetic payload is missing.
By studying the empty shell, you learn to spot the pathogen before it replicates in your mind.
Okay, let's look at the literal physical layout of the text again, because there is a spatial element to this void that I think is really interesting.
The typography.
Yes. We have a heading, excerpts from, and then we have the title again. In a physical book, or even on a web page, the white space around those words takes on a huge amount of visual weight.
Absolutely.
When there is no text to guide the eye down the page, the eye just kind of bounces off the repeated title and stares at the blank space below it.
White space in typography is never truly empty. It is highly active.
It tells you how to read.
It dictates the pacing of the reading experience. In a dense academic text, the lack of white space signals a slow, laborious, high-density extraction of data.
Right.
In poetry, expansive white space demands pauses, reflection, a slowing of the cognitive rhythm.
So what does the massive expanse of white space in our document demand?
In this context, because the predictive engine of the brain expected density, the how-to blueprint we talked about, the sudden endless white space acts as a visual representation of the cognitive error signal.
It is literally showing you the void.
It is the visual equivalent of a dial tone. The connection has been dropped.
Yes.
The white space does not invite reflection. It enforces an abrupt, jarring halt.
It is the visual silence after a loud noise. And because our rule on this deep dive is that we are strictly bound to discuss only the facts contained in the provided source material, we find ourselves entirely trapped in that white space.
We can't cheat.
We can't. We cannot bring in outside history. We cannot open up a browser and pull up his actual shareholder letters or his biography to fill the void.
No.
We cannot bring in our own knowledge of compound interest or value investing to save the document from itself. We are stranded on the island of these specific words.
And that strict adherence to the source material is the crucible that forces the deep analysis.
If we were allowed to cheat, if we were allowed to import external context to make the document make sense, we would be committing the exact cognitive error the document invites.
Hallucinating substance where there is none?
Exactly. By refusing to bridge the gap for the author, we maintain the integrity of the analysis. We hold the document accountable to its own borders.
We hold the mirror up to the mirror.
We really do. We have traced the letters of the title. We've examined the implications of the word excerpts. We have dissected the psychological weight of the names and the nouns.
And we have mapped the cognitive crash that occurs when the promise fails.
We have fundamentally exhausted the literal text provided. We have squeezed every drop of analytical potential out of, what, 8 repeated words?
We have thoroughly mapped the perimeter of the empty room.
We have. And acknowledging that we have reached the absolute limit of the provided text creates a natural causal link to wrapping up our direct analysis.
Right. We can't invent things.
We cannot magically conjure a financial strategy from a repeated title, and pretending we could would violate the core premise of why you, the listener, tune into this show.
The refusal to invent information is the ultimate act of respect for the listener's time.
Exactly. So let's pull back and synthesize what we've actually uncovered here.
Let's do it.
Today's deep dive explored a source that made an incredibly specific, incredibly seductive promise.
A huge promise.
It promised curated, highly concentrated insights excerpts into the cognitive machinery of a globally recognized figure regarding the concept of wealth.
But the factual, unyielding reality of the text provided was nothing more than a tautology.
A loop.
It was a signpost, pointing to a signpost, a menu that simply listed the word menu.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the value of spending this time analyzing a void becomes undeniably clear.
It does.
Why does this matter to you, the listener, who just wanted to learn something useful today?
It matters because this deep dive serves as a high-intensity workout for your critical faculties.
It builds that structural skepticism.
It highlights the absolute vital importance of separating the architecture of a promise from the delivery of the payload.
It's about training your brain not to eat the wrapper.
Precisely. In an information ecosystem where you are subjected to thousands of competing promises every single day, it is perilously easy to confuse the feeling of being informed with the rigorous reality of gaining knowledge.
You read a powerful headline, and your brain rewards you with a sense of proximity to wisdom.
But true learning, durable knowledge, requires the discipline to recognize when a source lacks the necessary depth to justify its own existence.
It requires the courage to look at a beautifully carved door, open it, see a brick wall, and admit, there is no library here.
Instead of pretending you read a book,
yeah.
It demands that we do not do the author's work for them. It prevents us from hallucinating intent, strategy, or context that isn't actively supported by the text in front of us.
Identifying an information void is not a failure of reading. It is a vital protective skill.
It saves your cognitive energy for sources that actually fulfill their structural promises.
It is the ultimate defense mechanism against the illusion of knowledge. And it brings us right back to that jarring step in the dark.
The falling sensation.
It is uncomfortable when your foot hits empty air. It is shocking when you lift the cloche and find an empty plate.
But that shock is deeply instructive.
It forces you to recalibrate your stride. It forces you to look closer at the next plate you are handed.
Exactly.
So, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over as you step back into the noise of your day.
Okay.
We've spent this entire time dissecting the structural reality of this source, this echo chamber of a title. Think about your own daily diet of information, the countless headlines and promises you scroll past.
The endless feed.
When a source boldly promises to reveal the intimate, complex machinery of how a prominent mind operates regarding a universally desired concept like money, but ultimately only hands you the title itself, does that absolute, unapologetic absence of information actually serve as the most profound lesson the document could possibly offer?
It makes you wonder.
Perhaps the void is the ultimate reminder that true, actionable, life-altering knowledge is never just handed to you passively in a headline or a summary. You must always rigorously demand the actual substance behind the words.